Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 19th of January. This hour of the program, a listener request actually from our last open line or the one before that. There are two professors at the University of Wisconsin River Falls who are teaching extremely interesting courses in race-related issues, the psychology and prejudice, the psychology of prejudice and racism, and also a course on race, class, and the news. And we talk with both of them this hour of the program. Dr. Sandy Ellis is professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, and Professor Ellis teaches the course in race, class, and news. These are the objectives of the course: to learn the social responsibility theory, to expand the understanding of the relationship between journalism and democracy, to recognize journalism's changing values concerning diversity, to become more sensitive to the issues of class and race in news coverage, and also in news organizations. They use, a number of different publications for their source material for the class, but they're using the New York Times to find and analyze articles dealing with race and class. Professor Ellis, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Should be a good conversation.
I'm so pleased to be part of it.
Also joining us is Professor Cindy Kernahan, who teaches the psychology of prejudice and racism. And one of the textbooks is, this may be one of the questions of the hour, why are all the black kids sitting in the cafeteria together? The course is designed to provide students with an understanding of the psychological impact of prejudice and racism in the United States. They will be looking at a number of topics, including white racial identity, white privilege, affirmative action, stereotyping, origins, functions, and consequences, a history of racism, and the list goes on. And we thank you very much, Professor Kernahan, for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you think about both of these classes. Some people will hear these descriptions of courses and say, hey, you know what? We've moved way beyond race in this country. We've got the problem settled here. We don't need to look at the psychology of it or how it manifests itself, because it really doesn't very much anymore.
Yeah, that's a pretty common thought, I think, sometimes for folks. From my perspective, it is very important because, in many ways, a lot of the ways that it affects us, we don't necessarily see, especially people who are white, not people of color. And so that's why I think it's sort of extra important, because we live in this time when a lot of people don't see the importance of it.
I would concur based on what my students say.
Yeah.
After we had the class, they say, wow, I never even thought about this. Mm-hmm. There's an example that I borrowed from Tim Wise. The fish don't notice the water. All semester long, my students kept saying, you know, it's just like the fish. They don't notice the water. We don't notice white privilege.
So what do you mean by white privilege? How does it manifest itself in American society? There's a big question to start there. How does it manifest itself in American society?
Well, that's Cindy's area. referring to her.
I think that there's a few ways you can think of it. I mean, it works on a very everyday sort of level, in that, you know, little simple things like walking around in stores and not necessarily being monitored as much. Now, that might depend on other variables too, like class and age, but race is equally important, if not more so, in some situations. And so things like that, everyday sorts of situations, knowing that the textbooks that your children see in school, for example, are going to have people that look like you or look like your children, so that they're going to feel represented, things like that. And then also on much larger levels that affect things like wealth and income, job discrimination, overall differences in terms of housing and segregation in housing, what housing is available and for whom, and criminal justice system and healthcare. There are huge racial disparities in healthcare. And so on all of those levels, I think privilege just sort of is something that a lot of people who are white just kind of take for granted, don't really think about much, because they probably aren't seeing a lot of the discrimination that happens, and they're not necessarily feeling it in their everyday lives. And because we sort of have this idea that society should be colorblind, everyone has an equal opportunity, we just don't necessarily see those things as much. And so sort of breaking through that is part of what my course entails.
And what happens to the students once they realize that they do have privilege once they start thinking about these issues that they hadn't thought about before.
Well, I can tell you what happened in my class, and I think Sandy's had similar experiences. They kind of go through this process of, a lot of theorists call it racial identity development. All of us go through racial identity development. For white students, what happens often is that they feel a variety of things. You see sometimes anger and resistance at these ideas in some students. I mean, disbelief. I've had students say to me, that can't really be true, right? You know, like I would give them fake information or something. And so there's some of that. Eventually, I think there's some feelings. There's a lot of my students talk about how guilty they feel. We try to talk about that and kind of talk about, you know, getting how that's just part of the identity development process. So there's guilt, there's anger, there's a variety of emotional responses that you see.
Mm-hmm. Professor Ellis, you say you use a foundation of social responsibility theory to explore representations of class and race in the American news media. What does that mean? What's a social responsibility theory?
I'll try to summarize it. Basically, back... we've had what's considered a libertarian theory of press for a long time, which was, you know, you go out and you do what you have to do and what's good for business and everything works out. In the 20s, the media got very sensational. There was a backlash. That's when a number of professional organizations started, my area being broadcast news. I'm particularly cognizant of the NAB starting then. That's when the Federal Communications Act and then the Communications Act of 1934 came along and emphasized the importance of broadcasting in the public interest. The Society of Professional Journalists got started. And what happened is people said, with the responsibility that the press gets via the First Amendment of the Constitution, the only business that's mentioned in the Constitution, we have greater responsibilities than other businesses as such. And that responsibility means we need to be a watchdog on government. We need to watch out for the public's interests. And this is a part of the public's interest, the well-being of its citizens.
I'm wondering, when you look at, let's just look at something that, you know, may seem superficial, except it's not, and that's the representation of who we are as an American society in terms of the news that we view. And I think that it's probably radically different because you're in a part of the state that is doesn't have a lot of African-American people living there, probably more Hmong people who are living there. What about the responsibility, even if you don't have a diverse kind of community that you're living in, to represent diversity in all its fine form in America on the news that you watch?
Well, the interesting thing is, in our communities here in western Wisconsin, we aren't diverse, but we live next door to the biggest metropolitan area in Minnesota, and that's whose TV market we're in.
Mm-hmm.
So we do see diversity in television. Where we don't see diversity is in our local newspapers, our small-town newspapers over here. We tend to get lost out here because we're so overwhelmed with Minnesota media, and people regularly say, thank God for WPR, we wouldn't know what was happening on in our own state. But it's still an issue because one of the factors is if you see people of color as anchors, that doesn't guarantee that they're making the news decisions if there aren't people of color who are reporters. And if you then go ahead and look and say who's managing the newsroom,
right,
it's rarely someone of color that's managing
right.
the newsroom. I mean, broadcast stations are smart, and they know about political perceptions, and they understand the importance of looking good to the whole audience. And so it's not uncommon to have a person of color on as an anchor, but waves happen, and for a while it'll be all white here, and then it'll go back, and they'll bring one or two people of color in.
It is interesting in a city like Milwaukee, where I'm from and where we broadcast every day, if you look at the news in Milwaukee, it's quite the opposite. You feel as though decisions have made, and again, mostly by white people who are making the management decisions because they run the news departments in this city and probably all over the country. But there's been a conscious attempt, I think, to make sure that their broadcasters are more diverse, their reporters are more diverse, the people you see on the air are more diverse because of the makeup of the community, I believe.
And then the other question is, what do we see in the news stories, and who are the people who are the sources in the news stories? One of the things that I worked hard with my students, since most of them are going into journalism, and that was the goal of my class, is to at least have them be aware. And we discussed the fact that they would have almost no power when they start out in the news business, but they need to be aware of it. How you deal with stories, who you should talk to. Do you talk to one local black minister and assume that he or she speaks for all the black people in the community? That's a lot of pressure there.
Right.
So what we were working for is at least awareness. And I know there's a lot more now than when I was in the news business, and even 5 or 10 years ago. I mean, all the professional organizations regularly have sessions when they have seminars on this.
It is interesting what she says, Dr. Kernahan, that we do, even in 2007, figure, well, what does the Hispanic community think about this? What does the Hmong community think about it? What does the black community? That we all have our own little communities instead of making a whole lot of progress to not seeing each other in terms of a color line.
Right. I think it's complicated because you have to, on the one hand, you need to make sure it's sort of, we're similar and we're different at the same time. So we need to make sure that we understand that we all pretty much have, you know, a lot of the same values. We have the same desires and goals in terms of what we want in our lives. And so in that way, race, it doesn't really make people very different. But in terms of people's everyday experience, race does affect how we're treated every day. And that's why you get, you know, radically, all you have to do is look at people's responses to things in the news. For example, like Hurricane Katrina, when you look at the vast racial divides and how that's perceived by black and white Americans and other groups of color, what you start to see is the differences in people's experiences and the differences in their everyday lives that they experience by virtue of their race along with other social factors.
Exactly.
And I think that's why the representation is partially so important. A lot of studies, there have been some excellent work on this that looks at how our groups represented, and a lot of it, I think Sandy was kind of getting to this, is like a lot of it looks at, you know, particular aspects of certain groups or looks to represent them with one viewpoint, but it doesn't really show their everyday lives as much. It doesn't really show a variety of responses from those groups. And if we had more of that, I think we'd understand each other better.
Yeah. Let's be specific for a moment and look at a story that has gone as far as the International Herald Tribune has covered the death of the Green Bay hunter Cha Vang and the arrest with first-degree intentional homicide in the death James Nichols, who was arrested recently. Vang's death not charged as a hate crime, but Nichols has made statements about his being Hmong and gave opinions of Hmong hunters, according to the complaint. Can both of you tell me how this issue has been played on television, in the press, in this part of the state, and it seems to me as though we have a whole long way to go when it comes to understanding the Hmong culture and to getting along with each other. This is an underreported story, I believe.
I would concur with that. I have been out of town over the holidays, so I missed a great deal of that. But I did see some of the stories. What was carried up here was basically what came from the Associated Press, and it was quite abbreviated. There was very little information. You learned that there was a Hmong hunter and another guy was being charged, and he says it was self-defense, and that's all we got. We didn't get any additional coverage about cultural implications, what might have led to this. Well, I don't want to use a blanket statement like that. I didn't see it. It could have been there, but having been out of town some, I haven't seen multi-part series or anything of that kind.
Nothing like that. It certainly has brought up in the few stories that I've seen, they've certainly brought up the, you know, the connection to the incident you know, a couple of years back, and how mm-hmm. this, again, speaks to the tension that exists in the woods. And also, I saw a little piece about, you know, is this a hate crime or not, and some sort of debate about that. And I think that issue, again, shows, that particular incident shows how people's perceptions are very different depending on, can be very different depending on their racial group and therefore their racial experiences. I mean, we talked about when the first killings occurred, Chai Vang, in that case a few years back, we talked about it in class, and we talked about the differences and how white people and people of color, particularly Hmong people, would view that incident. Because for a white person, oftentimes you heard in the press a lot of white people saying, not everyone, but a lot of people saying, this is not racial, this has nothing to do with race, it has nothing to do with that at all. Whereas if you ask someone who's Hmong, they would say absolutely it does. And I think part of why that difference exists is because white people don't necessarily have, they may not know what that fear feels like, to feel someone sort of pointing you out because of your race and feeling threatened and feeling like your safety is at risk. Whereas people of color may have more experience with that. They may have different kinds of experiences with law enforcement or with other people and being sort of monitored. And so they're more used to sort of being perceived in terms of their race and are more uncomfortable with it. So they can understand where that tension comes from mm-hmm. on the part of the Hmong hunters, whereas I think for whites, so it's a bit more difficult just by virtue of daily activities, differences there.
Mm-hmm. I think it was somebody from the a St. Paul organization, the Coalition for Community Relations, mm-hmm. who said, as angry as I am about the details, I urge everyone to remain calm and collected. I want to encourage non-Hmong and Hmong alike, particularly whites, to take this opportunity to talk about race and racism.
Yeah, I think it's a good opportunity.
Yeah. So do you do that in your class? When something like this happens, I would imagine it's on the minds of you,
yeah.
both of you, and also of your students. Do you jump right into it?
I do. Absolutely, I do.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times my students will bring things up. I mean, they will bring things in. It's very, in my course, as in Sandy's, it's very discussion-oriented. And so we definitely talk about anything current that's coming up that we can relate to the theories that we're discussing.
Yeah. That's welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're talking with Professor Sandy Ellis, professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, who teaches a class, Race, Class, and News. Professor Cindy Kernahan, associate professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, who teaches a course in the psychology of prejudice and racism. Did I give you our phone number? We sure would love to have you join us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you are in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Our web line's open. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And as the phone calls are coming in, which they are for Professor Ellison, for Professor Kernahan, let me ask the question that is, I think, the title of one of the textbooks that is used in one of your classes, only I'll expand it. Why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? Why are all the white kids sitting together? Why are all the Asian kids sitting together? Why?
Well, a lot of it has to do with racial identity. When you look particularly at the middle school years, when you look at an elementary school cafeteria, you probably won't see this as much.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see it as much because the kids aren't really being perceived too much in terms of race. They certainly recognize racial differences. We can see those, you know, by 3 to 5 years old, but the difference is we don't get perceived that way in the world as much. But when kids hit adolescence, the rest of the world starts to see them more, particularly if they're children of color. They start to get seen in terms of their race. And so they start to think more in those terms. And so a lot of researchers have sort of documented this process that happens during adolescence, where kids start to see themselves more in that way, and they start to get maybe treated a little bit differently, perhaps by teachers or out in other situations. And so it just becomes more comfortable in many ways during that part of the development process to talk to people, to be with people who are experiencing things similarly to you. And if you were to take your experiences, let's say, of maybe, you know, some sort of questionable treatment by a teacher, if you're a black student, let's say, and you took that to your white friend, they may not be able to understand it. They might even question it. And so it's a little bit easier to talk to someone who's experienced similar things.
Mm-hmm. Do you please weigh in on this, Dr. Ellis?
it's an interesting thing, particularly at my university, because our diversity level is not non-existent. What is it, Cindy? 3%, 4%?
I think it's something like that. We're actually fourth in the state, I think, in third or fourth in the state in terms of diversity level of the UW schools. But yeah, it's only, I think it's 3 to 4%.
Mm. And so when I taught this class, and I have to tell you, I taught this class for the first time this fall. So I'm still building on it, but we are definitely offering it again and making it regular. But in my class of 17 people, I had one black student, one Indian, East Indian student, a student who is half Filipino and half white, and the rest were white kids. Mm-hmm. And so it took us almost all semester to get to the point where we could talk about this. And that had to do with the white kids getting comfortable recognizing the issue. But when we did talk about it, they were just amazed, A, the white kids, that this has been going on, and the kids who had experienced racism were saying, I know what's going on. This is my life.
Definite differences.
Mm-hmm. So it's the lone black student in my class at the very end said, well, I want you to know, when I'm on this campus, I know I stand out. I feel very alone. And that was a very powerful statement, I think, to all of us in the class.
And certainly keeps a lot of students of color, perhaps, from being on the campus.
Yeah.
Oh, indeed.
I think it can.
Mm-hmm.
I think it can. Because if a student comes to campus and they just don't feel like there's a place they can go or a place that they're comfortable with where, again, you know, maybe they can, it's not like they're going to spend all of their time there, but just somewhere where you can go and say, you know, this is what I experienced today, or this is, and feeling like you're going to be understood, I think is important. That's why things like, you know, multicultural student centers or, you know, student unions and things like that can be so important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not understood sometimes.
Let's go to Andrew from La Crosse. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. In our area, we have a few different organizations that cater to or try to involve youth of different ethnic and cultural backgrounds. Some of those groups are aimed at strengthening a specific cultural group or background in our area, and some are aimed at integrating them and sharing experiences together. There's been a recent conflict in our media involving two of the different groups, and I noticed it as somewhat of a problem, and I'm wondering the benefits or negative aspects of those two types of programs at integrating different cultural backgrounds and then at strengthening specific groups within our communities.
Who wants to take it on first? Professor Kernahan?
I think, actually, they're both important. You know, sometimes I think those two goals can be sort of seem to be pitted against each other. Like, it's sort of like integration versus segregation, you know. And it seems to me that really you need both in a lot of ways. I mean, it's like you have to recognize race to sort of, you can't get beyond it unless you recognize it. And so I think a lot of times you have to have those groups strengthening, you know, as far as how that group's represented or how they're treated in the community. You absolutely have to have that, but you also have to have some form of integration. And so a lot of the groups on our campus, I think, try to sort of have those two goals in mind. And I think sometimes they get misunderstood, too. They get misunderstood by others that don't understand that really both of those goals are important. Mm. And so sometimes, like I said, with the multicultural student centers, you know, a lot of times people look at that and they'll say, oh, well, that's just that group segregating themselves, and that's not bad. Or like if you have a black history class, people say, well, aren't they just, you know, segregating themselves further by creating this? No, that's important, too. I mean, you want to recognize those groups and let them, you know, be represented, and then at the same time work towards understanding of other people. So I think both goals are important, and it's too bad that they often get sort of pitted against each other, I think.
Hmm.
Well, and the other interesting thing is, white people look at groups of people of color and say, why are they all hanging out together, and never look around and notice that the vast majority of white people are hanging out together.
That's exactly true. Right. And they might be a little suspicious. Why are those people of color all hanging out together, right?
But they never question the fact that they just got through eating lunch with 10 white people.
Yeah, right.
And they weren't plotting any strange and wonderful things.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. I want to bring up, and I don't want to get into a political conversation here, but it seems to me as though, I want to talk about Barack Obama for a moment.
Mm.
Because it seems to me as though we have now, for the first time really that I can remember, and maybe you can, your memories will take you somewhere else, but we have a man who exhibits all these different races. You know, he's got half black and half white, and he's lived in Kenya, and he's lived in Hawaii, and he's lived in the Philippines, and he's a guy of the world in so many ways. And there's something about that that's either very attractive to the American people, or they're repulsed by it. You know, there's this undercurrent of hatred for him, too, which is starting to manifest itself, which scares the heck out of me. But it's also interesting that we're seeing somebody. And he's not espousing black causes, you know, as Jesse Jackson might or as Al Sharpton might. He's talking about Iraq. He's talking about health care. He's talking about all these things. And I'm wondering, tell me, what does that mean? Professor Ellis, what does it mean for a black man to really captivate us and to have center stage on giving an opinion on so many news events of the day?
Well, to me, I think it has to do, when we use the universal us, it has to do with where you're coming from. For the people who are hoping for improvements in this great issue that faces our country that we, my students called it the elephant in the room that we all ignore,
mm-hmm.
Those people, I think, are excited because they think, my Lord, maybe there's hope.
Mm.
At the same time, some people are very, very threatened by that, and certainly Cindy can talk more about why people are threatened by people of other races. But if you don't know people of other races, you believe all kinds of odd notions that we have in our history that bear no resemblance to truth,
mm-hmm.
and it's a frightening thing to you. It has to do with power.
Hmm. Yeah, I think, too, a lot of times I think people's fear, and perhaps this is where the undercurrent of fear and threat and hatred might come from, is sort of the idea that, you know, with, let's say, with a black candidate, for example, a lot of times, and I know this happened with Jesse Jackson back in, I think it was 88 when he ran, one of the first times, it's sort of like, are you going to represent American interests or black interests?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like this assumption that you have to do one or the other, and you have to choose which, you know, which side are you on. And so it's, and it's not framed necessarily as black versus white. It's sort of black versus mainstream. I mean, that and again, that's part of white privilege, is not recognizing that sort of the dominant culture often is dominated by a lot of white interests. And so I think that that's part of where fear can come from, and also part of why he can be seen so positively, because he has been covered as more of sort of a regular candidate, you know, who talks about a lot of important issues that are on the minds of a lot of Americans. And so I think that's part of why he generates so much interest and so much appreciation and everything, is because he is seen as not being that way, not being sort of, you know, oh, the self-interested black politician who only cares about these issues.
Do you think that he has moved us in a sense? And just the image on the television and the way that he smoothly speaks and intelligently speaks about so many issues, Professor Ellis, that he's moving us beyond race.
Well, I think he's helping.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit that I come to this knowledge late, but it always looks easier to those of us who are white than it does to people who are black.
Mm-hmm.
I think he helps. It's certainly in his favor that he's very intelligent, very well-spoken, has a good background, seems to be quite successful, appears to be happily married. He's all the positives that I think white people are going to need to accept someone to come into that role. Now, and this is just my opinion. And I'll be honest, he seems really appealing to me because he seems like a delightful human being. And he seems to be very, he thinks very deeply about things, and he obviously thinks before he talks.
which is a nice change.
It's always good, yeah. Let's go to Tom from Waukon, Iowa. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a son who's just starting journalism in college, and my question has to do with how do you get news organizations to be more brave? I think in a smaller community, there's not going to be a lot of support, if it's an all-white community, for articles about race. And this includes all the media. I had a concern with WPR back the previous hunting murder issue with Hmongs and whites. I had asked somebody to cover that. I thought the treasure of information and experience was just, you know, WPR could have provided a lot for that. So I hope, but how do you get people, I think younger is better because they have more white experience, but how do you get people to talk about the American Indian culture or about Arab culture or something that does not have a lot of constituents locally and is not necessarily going to increase their fund drive? That's my question.
All right, Professor Kernahan.
I think it's difficult. You have to start. I'm starting to think, I've been teaching this for a few years now, and I'm starting to think the way that you have to come at it is you have to show how these issues affect everyone and how they, I mean, the truth is that race really does affect every community, even if that community is not very diverse. It can affect that community in a variety of ways, and certainly it's going to more in the future. I mean, when you look at the demographics of our country, it's only becoming more diverse. I mean, I hope I'm not getting this number wrong, but I think it's like something like 3 in 5 children under the age of, I think it's elementary school age or something, are children of color, maybe older than that. And so when you look at the demographics, they are shifting quickly, and they're going to be, you know, we have more immigrant children than at any point since, I think, the early 1900s. And so those things are important, and so I think you have to be able to kind of show, even if it's not obvious right away, you have to have people in the news and other organizations that are willing to sort of look at that. How does race affect our community, and how? Because it certainly does. It's definitely there. It's just sometimes a little bit harder to see. And if you can get people to see it, how it affects their own life and their own interests, which it certainly does, I think that helps.
And have you been able to point to instances, Professor Ellis, where the media has really shown in this regard?
Well, I would say that a lot of the coverage of Katrina was not good, but there was some that got to it. And I guess where this comes to my mind, my students listened to Ira Glass' show, This American Life. We went back and listened to his show that ran the week after the hurricane hit. And it's called After the Flood, and it's easily accessible. And it dealt with how it was happening for the blacks compared to the whites. And the concern was that a lot of people weren't seeing the real story. And when my students listened to this radio show, all the white kids said, I didn't know. I thought everything was okay. I didn't know these things were going on for black people there. And there was some coverage, and of course, off and on, and since then, there's been more and more coverage. The issue came up. I have to say, I think it's fallen off the radar, much to my dismay.
Yeah.
I don't think it's done or over, but at least in some ways, some reporters and some news organizations really brought this out. Sometimes you had to work to find it if you didn't live near there.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be a place, I think, the most recent thing that's become the national story.
Well, maybe the Saints just need to go to the Super Bowl so that the press can look at that issue again, which they might have to, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go next to Glenn from Manitowoc. Hi, Glenn.
Hello, good morning. I hope I don't come across wrong. I'll have to give a little personal history so that my statements are understood. I'm 57 years old. I lived in Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Chicago, San Francisco. I'm currently living in Manitowoc. My take on racism is very much akin to theology. It's really a personal thing and a matter of exposure, that I agree. I've had plenty of exposure. Unfortunately, I have had plenty of exposure of reverse discrimination where people of not my race ended up putting me in the hospital. That said, I never held it personal. I think more in these times, we're dealing more with economic prejudice. I think the real answer is more education and more focus on what's really threatening our young people is access to meaningful employment, which is leaving this country at a horrendous rate. And I think therein lies more of the answers. I came to Manitowoc in 77. This community at that time I immediately deemed as incredibly racist and ignorant of people of other races. Lived here for some time, obviously, and I have watched that erode as more people of different races moved into the community and people simply just got used to seeing them. Racism is a personal thing. I see huge improvements over the decades that I've been watching, which is a long time, an old hippie. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the biggest challenge that we're facing today is economic opportunity for our youth, and especially education and affordability of education. Until we address those issues, the powers that be are utilizing things like racism as a divisive issue.
All right.
That's what I have to say, and hope I came across
correctly. You're fine. No. Yeah, you're fine, Glenn.
There's a couple of things I thought that were interesting that he brought up. One is, I think it's so true that when people have personal relationships and they have experiences with other people that are, you know, of a different race, that really is incredibly important. It cannot be, you know, can't be overstated how important that is to have those experiences. I mean, that's really what changes people's attitudes and their feelings. And education is very important, too. But those personal experiences, that's part of why segregation, I think, is really so damaging and creates a lot of the problems that we see, because we don't live near each other. We don't go to school together.
Right.
Those kinds of things are important. And I would also say, too, the other thing about the economic issue, I think that social class and the economic disparities that you see are very important. I mean, clearly access to education and those sorts of things are very important. But I'm always hesitant to totally try to separate class from race, because the bottom line is, when you look at differences in income and wealth, those turn on race too. And so those things, I think, are inseparable in so many ways. And I think it's easy, and a lot of times people want to say it's just this or it's just that. And I think it's much more complicated than that. It's both. And, you know, look at the wealth disparities that you see. There's 8 times difference between the average black family and the average white family in the United States in terms of net wealth, you know. Well, where does that come from? That comes from a long history that we often don't acknowledge very much. It goes back to the, you know, the days of slavery and before, where you see these differences that were created by, you know, differences, obviously, in opportunity to accumulate wealth. And even now you see it when you look at our segregated housing. And so a lot of people, you know, most of their right. wealth comes from their house. Well, if my house is in a neighborhood that's considered, you know, quote, good, it's going to be worth more. Where if it's in a neighborhood that's not good, you know, it's not going to be worth more. And those turn on racial lines. So mm-hmm. it's very difficult mm-hmm. to separate those two things. And I'm always a bit uncomfortable saying it's just one or it's just the other. I think it definitely is both of them.
More phone calls in a moment. We are talking about race this hour of the program. Our guests are from the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Professor Cindy Kernahan is with us. Professor Kernahan teaches a course in psychology of prejudice and racism. And Professor Sandy Ellis is a professor of journalism at UW River Falls. Her course is Race, Class, and News. Lines are filled. Keep the number in mind as we take your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls. Ray from Eau Claire is next. Hi, Ray.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. Thank you so much. I got to chuckling when you were talking about the birds of feather concept and how people tend to gather with those who are like them. And it just brought to mind an anecdote I heard about the old Charlton Heston, Roddy McDowell science fiction series, Planet of the Apes. And they had a lot of supporting actors, of course, to play the various other apes in the movie. And so African-Americans, Asian, Hispanics, a lot of Caucasian people. And my guess is they must, because they spent so much time in makeup with those expensive masks they had to wear, they couldn't really peel them off just to put down a sandwich or two. So at lunchtime, they had to pause, and maybe with soups or liquids, they stayed in costume as they ate. And the curious thing is, it mattered not whether the person underneath was black or Asian or Hispanic. The gorillas gathered off to one side in their group, and the chimpanzees separated themselves from the orangutans.
Hmm.
They were more comfortable that way.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Anybody want to respond to that? Okay, we can move on. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Mark from Waukesha next. Hi, Mark.
Hi. The reason why I was calling is back in the 1970s, I attended Tulane University in New Orleans, and at that time I had a strong need to feel a part of a group. And as a gay white male, there were no campus opportunities for that until we were able to pull together a group of students that could identify with some of the issues that I felt were important, and including myself. New Orleans back at that time was a large city, and there were lots of people that participated in our activities, the activities of a gay student union back then. But I would be a little more concerned about the absence of such opportunities in places like northern Wisconsin, where there aren't a lot of gay students attending. And when talking about cultural and racial issues in classes such as what your guests are talking about, I have a sense that gay and lesbian issues are not really what is thought of in terms of cultural diversity. It's more black and Asian and Hispanic rather than sexual orientation. Yet those issues are extremely important in helping to form a sense of identity, especially among students in their early in formative years in meeting other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could comment about those that whole issue of sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Transgender students are even less common. But the whole issue is very, very potent, especially if you're one of them.
Yeah, exactly. You bring up a very good point. Dr. Kernahan, you want to take this first?
Yeah, I think that that is really important. I mean, when you look at the identity process, it's going to be very similar when you look at something like sexual orientation in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously there are some differences from race in terms of being identified and self-identifying and all of that. But I think it's just as important to have those groups around and to have, again, it's just that universal sort of human need to feel represented, to feel like there are people who understand what you're experiencing. That is, it's amazing to me how important that is to people to feel validated, you know, to feel like their experience has been experienced by someone else. And so I would argue that those groups are really important. I think sometimes it's unfortunate that we get in these positions where, you know, it's like, is this going to be diversity or is that going to be diversity? And sometimes it just seems kind of useless in a way to fight over those things when really I think there should be, if a group is stigmatized and experiencing bias, which clearly sexual orientation brings up quite a bit of that, transgender issues, you need to have those outlets available, you know, just as much. It's just mm-hmm. as important.
And I would just add that it seems to me that at more and more college campuses and even now high school campuses, GLBT groups are being organized, and I think that's a very positive aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree. But in some cases, even in smaller rural communities like River Falls and Wausau and so on up there, there aren't as many opportunities for those students to be able to come out because there aren't a lot of social support. Back in the Earl administration here in the state, Tony Earl had a governor's council on lesbian and gay issues, and one of the things that they were able to do was to provide speakers and to help places in rural parts of the state identify, meet with, and talk with people who were from the community who were gay and lesbian, as well as people from other parts of the state who were comfortable in talking about those issues.
Yeah, and that's a great idea. I mean, it's they do face a lot of opposition, and they, I mean, those groups especially, I think, face a lot of opposition oftentimes, and that is really important. I mean, we had a speaker come to our campus last year, and it was amazing how powerful. Aswar Twalo, I think I'm saying that correct, he came here and spoke about being a gay NFL player who was in the closet while he was in the NFL. He played for the Vikings and the Packers, and he talked about that, and it was so powerful and so meaningful to our students, especially the students who are gay and lesbian, because they were, again, they're seeing themselves represented, and they're seeing their issues being taken seriously, and you just can't understate how important that is.
Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks so much for your call. Terry from Appleton. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Can you hear me okay? Hello?
Yeah, we hear you.
Okay, good. I'm having difficulty hearing you, but I'll go ahead. One of the things, my son was just at a meeting at his school, and it was mandatory attendance on Martin Luther King Day, and basically what it was is telling all the white students what they had to do in order to understand how the black students felt. Well, it just got to be a resentment kind of a thing because it had been so force-fed on these kids for years, you know, about racism. And they finally asked some of the black kids, you know, how they were feeling about it and what their, if they had experienced the racism on the campus there. And, you know, they all said no. So it just got to be one of these things that just felt like it was obligatory to bring on the white guilt, as your guest said, that's what some of the students are feeling. And, but it kind of brings up a question to my mind, and what that is that, you know, why is it that if we want to blame whites for the plight of the blacks, why do we put the onus strictly on whites to solve the problem of racism? We don't seem to expect anything in return from the black community. We provide public education, and granted the system in many places has broken down, but is that completely the problem of whites? Or, you know, what is it when you have black students telling each other you don't perform well because acting white? That is a cultural thing that ultimately degenerates a complete school system, and it has happened, and we allow it to happen, but yet when we have someone like Oprah that comes out and says, I want to build a school in South Africa because I'm tired of going into black schools in the inner cities and just seeing that these kids don't want to learn, she gets castigated by the media, and the same happens with Bill Cosby and anybody else who speaks out and says it's time for blacks to take responsibility themselves and reform their own issues. But we are big enablers is what it comes down to. And I think your guests are probably some of the most guilty in that regard.
Hey, I just want to hear. I want to hear more about your comments on Martin Luther King Day. What happened at the school that you found offensive? What was the nature of the attack on whites that took place at the program, or what was it?
Well, it was just the assumption that, you know, you're white, you should feel guilty.
That was brought out in the program somehow, or
yeah, and it was a lot of you know, just people being presumed guilty because they're white. You know, I've always maintained that diversity is really nothing more than skin deep. If you look for diversity of opinion, that gets disregarded completely as anything worth considering. But the biggest problem I think that we have is the fact that we have no expectations of the black community.
Yeah, all right, I got your point. I doubt that Martin Luther King celebrations are to make, you know, white people feel guilty. We have a lot to learn still from the civil rights struggle. But take this on. Who wants to take this on?
I have a couple of answers, but Sandy, would you?
Well, let's go with yours first, other than the fact that I would say, based on what my students said, they think that dealing with issues of race is a very important class that ought to be in the public schools, that people should start early understanding how we respond to people of color, and not just people of color, why we respond to people who are different from us the way we do. And that might make things easier to understand. But I'll pass it on over to Cindy.
Yeah, I think... a few things. I mean, one, I think I think diversity types of training can be done wrong. You know, they can feel like they're forced. They're, you know, a lot of times if something happens, it's like, oh, well, they have this forced diversity training. And I don't necessarily think that's a good way to do it. I think it can be done wrong. I think when it's done a little better, then you have the experience that Sandy's had and that I have overwhelmingly had in my classes where people are very positive and they like it. So it's not force-fed. It's more of a, you know, here's some information, let's think about it and let's talk about it and let you put your own voice into it. That is extremely important. And if it's done in that way, I think it's very powerful and it's very useful. And you also get away from, by doing that, you get away from one of his other main points about sort of whose responsibility is it and
right.
whose blame is it. I think that's really, in many ways, that's the way a lot of these racial issues get framed, and it's just totally, it's just not a useful way to look at it. You know, it's a lot of times people focus on, am I racist? Am I to blame? Am I guilty? And I think part of getting beyond that really is to recognize that it's no one group's, you know, it's not useful to look at it that way. It's no one group's problem exactly. And I think we do ask the black community and other communities, we ask a lot of those groups. We ask them to do many things. And so I think a lot of these things are really, really stereotypes and sort of missing a lot of the points. I mean, when you look at black achievement in inner city schools, it's not just about students saying, you know, I don't have to do anything. There's so much going on there.
Right.
It's more complicated than I can address. But,
yeah. And we have to stop at this point
yeah.
anyhow. So thank you both very much for being with us. A very interesting hour. Thanks to Professor Cindy Kernahan, who is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, teaches a class in the psychology of prejudice and racism. And thanks to Professor Sandy Ellis, Professor of Journalism at UW River Falls, who teaches a class on race, class, and news. Rhonda Fanning produced the program. Thanks, Rhonda. John Treader, our on-air producer here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to John as well. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll be with you again on Monday at 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network.